He is planning on standing at the 2015 general election. That's prompted lots of speculation about which seat he could choose. And today there's reports that he is actually on the list for South Thanet. Now, that's a Kent seat, a seaside coastal town, and it's one of the ones that we were expecting to be high on his list of priorities.
We'll find out the judge's verdict in the Oscar Pistorius murder trial on September the 11th. Both sides have now finished summing up, with the athlete's defence aiming to prove one last time that he's innocent of murdering his girlfriend. Countries affected by the Ebola outbreak are being told to step up border checks as an international health emergency is declared. More than 960 people have now died. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM 93.2.
You are listening to BCFM.
Seamlessly running in there. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Thanks to all down at the Bloom Fiesta, but I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Councillor for Whitchurch Park, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, initial reports that a 34-year-old homeless man, Matthew Simmons, had been assaulted before his body parts were found in a Bristol recycling site have been discounted this week. It seems he was only rough sleeping in a Swindon wheelie bin, failed to shout loud enough to get the attention of the bin men, who emptied him into a dust cart to be crushed. That's the second such death this week, with the freshly crushed body of an unnamed man being discovered in a Dublin rubbish tip too this week. And the same thing happened here in Bristol less than 2 years ago. An unfortunate Canadian student, Garrett Elsley, who was emptied from a Bristol wheelie bin into a dustcart crusher. Brighton maths teacher Scott Williams, too. This happened to him in 2009. So after the latest grisly incident, we ask, what drives people to spend the night in a wheelie bin? And look at the plight of Bristol's ever-growing army of homeless people. And Gaza, we look at Zionism's powerful Westminster lobby and how the Israeli state lost its soul in the 1960s by occupying Palestine and sacking Mossad's Issa Harel, the only intelligence officer in the world who was still actively hunting down Nazi war criminals. Also, as NATO pulls out of Afghanistan, the highest-ranking US soldier so far, a general, is shot dead at an Afghan army training facility near Kabul. As the latest Afghan election fails, has the 13-year-long occupation won any hearts and minds? And as NATO readies itself for its annual summit over the river in Newport and rolls up its sleeves once more for a new fight with Russia, we ask, is this supposedly defensive North Atlantic Treaty Organisation gone off on its own megalomaniac mission creep to take over the world? On the centenary of Britain's entry into World War One, we hear how Britain came into the war too. And following on from last week's creation versus evolution debate, finally we hear from legendary Arizona talk show host and US naval intelligence veteran William Cooper get his take on one of the great iconic films about the dawn of man. That's Stanley Kubrick's classic 2001 A Space Odyssey. Plus, it's Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, and all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 21. Sunny tomorrow, possibly stormy, and disruptive weather on Sunday. That means for travel and that sort of thing. Next week, highs of 21 degrees Celsius, breezy with scattered showers and sunny spells on Monday and Tuesday. The rest of the week, sunshine and showers. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of August, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Hi, Helen. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
First, some news about Baroness Barbara today.
Well, yes. I think I was as surprised as many people have been to find out that Barbara Jank, the former leader of the Lib Dems in Bristol, has been elevated to the House of Lords.
So she was also leader of the council, wasn't she, as well? So
she
maybe
was
that's
on,
why.
On several occasions, yes. Although, well, I'm guessing that she's been nominated by the Liberal Democrats.
Okay, so that's an interesting little bit of news. Also, we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks with Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dem group on the council and with the mayor about the, you know, is the mayor working? happening. It's a couple of years, just about a couple of years into the mayor's tenancy in the city. What are your thoughts on that topic? Is the new system with the mayor in charge, some would say, a dictator, although he can be de-elected, of course, in a couple of years' time? Is it all working?
Well, I think... I mean, this is going to sound like a politician's answer, isn't it? But I think that, there's two different questions here. One is this mayor working? And the other is, do mayoral systems work? And I think that a lot of people are realising that there is a huge amount of power vested in one person's hands now under the mayoral system, and even more so in Bristol, because our mayor, George Ferguson, has chosen not to delegate decision-making powers.
Hang on a minute, he's got his cabinet, hasn't he?
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. He doesn't delegate decision-making powers to his cabinet. Those people are only there, including the Labour, the two from the Labour group, in an advisory capacity.
Well, when he was here
so
2 weeks ago...
he makes all the decisions.
Well, when he was here 2 weeks ago, he was adamant that he does put those decisions out, delegate them to cabinet members.
Well... under the Constitution, he doesn't. It's actually him who signs off all of the decisions, and the decisions that the cabinet make are advisory. They give advice to the mayor. You're right that, you know, nine times out of ten he will agree with that advice, but there are some times when people in the cabinet have disagreed with him, but he's overridden them.
Okay, give us an example of something that's affects the city, which is a decision that he's made, where maybe in the old system it would have been much more of a collective decision.
Well, I think you know, it's become a bit of a chestnut now, but the whole issue about the parking zones, and I think that pretty well speaking, there's cross-party agreement that you do need to control residents' parking. But I think the very much sort of one-size-fits-all way that he's gone about it...
OK, specifically, though, it's very easy to say, oh, yeah, we would have done it differently, but be specific.
Well, I am being specific. The two things that Labour did when we were in control and had that policy as well, one was that the referendums in residential areas were binding. So where people wanted it, we brought it in, and that's clearly not been the case here. We've had some areas that said no to it in referenda that have had it imposed on them. And the other thing was that, and I know that George Ferguson feels frustrated by the slowness of things happening within the council, but actually sometimes if you do things a bit more slowly, a bit more thoroughly, you let people respond, you adjust systems because they live there and they can see what would work and what wouldn't, then you get to the same place in the end. And you don't have all the, you know, argy-bargy that George Ferguson has had over the parking zones, where even some of his supporters have become to be very frustrated by him.
Well, we like referenda around here.
We like referenda. And here's a thing about the mayoral system that Bristol, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, so I think you discussed it a couple of weeks ago with the Lib Dem leader, Gary Hopkins. Bristol is out of step with the other mayoral authorities in the country because the legislation that gave Bristol its mayor was different from that which gave the other cities. And whereas in other cities, and indeed it has been done in Stoke and in Doncaster, they can have a referendum to see whether they want to carry on with a mayoral system. In Stoke they decided not to, in Doncaster they decided to. But we don't even have that luxury in Bristol. We'd have to have primary legislation through Parliament in order to get rid of the mayoral system in Bristol. So I think one thing that we could think about doing is how we get Bristol on the same footing as everywhere else. I'm not saying whether I would vote, I don't know yet, yes or no in a referendum to keep the mayor, but at least I'd like to be given the choice.
And so Gary Hopkins was saying that at the last full council meeting, the same day, the Lib Dems launched a petition online, at least some sort of campaign, I think it was on change.org, in order to call for this, for changing the legislation, changing the law, so that Bristol could have a referendum in the future and make another decision as to whether it still wanted to hang on to the mayor. So do you support that in principle?
In principle, I absolutely do, because I just think that it doesn't sound very democratic, does it, to not have the power of changing your minds about how we want the city to be governed and having to be answerable to Whitehall. And the whole thrust of the localism and devolution agenda is around giving people more control and not less.
Well, you're also there, it's not just the residents' parking that this affects. What about things like education? How is the mayor affected affected the way that's dealt with? Because I know, for example, we've had the local Conservative MP up in Kingswood, Chris Skidmore, saying he doesn't actually think local authorities should be involved in education.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because that was very much the previous Secretary of State, Michael Gove's view. And in fact, we've done a report within Bristol saying what is the role of the local authority in education now. So many, this kind of mixed diet of free schools, academies, trust schools, all the rest of it. You have to say, well, what is the role for the local authority? And although it is, you know, legislatively it has been diminished, actually there are still places where the local authority sets such a good model that schools want to be part of it. And I think that that's what we should aim for in Bristol, that although we've got all these different forms of governance of schools, you want people to feel that all of the schools are part of the Bristol family, because it's all of Bristol's kids who are being educated there.
Okay, from Bristol, winging our way hundreds of miles up north to Scotland, we've had quite a momentous, well, some people say boring, but momentous debate this week between the former Labour Chancellor, Alistair Darling, and Alex Salmond from the SNP, Scottish National Party, about Scottish devolution. What are your thoughts about that? Who do you think did the best? Which way is it going to go?
Well, I absolutely loved what I saw of the debate. And I thought it was quite funny, really, because the day after, because I think, you know, the general agreement is that Alistair Darling won the debate. And certainly the polls seem to be reinforcing that. There were more people saying no, and the people who changed their minds because of the debate, more of them were going to the no side. But the SNP seemed to be running around like headless chickens the next day, because they hadn't expected their chap not to come out of the debate on top. Next day, they decided that the line was that people aren't attracted by kind of macho men in suits, middle-aged blokes knocking seven bells out of each other. That isn't how you engage people with politics. Now, I happen to agree with that bit, but the funny thing was, of course, that the TV debate was at the request of Alex Salmond. He's been saying, let's have a debate, and he wanted it to be David Cameron who he would debate with. David Cameron refused. Alex Salmond carried on pressing for a TV debate, and Alistair Darling, as the leader of the Better Together campaign, led on that, and I think he did a fantastic job.
But Better Together seemed to be bamboozling the Scots, excuse the expression, but they really do seem to be saying, well, we're not going to give you your own currency, and sticking two fingers up at them, and making this the main issue of almost all the discussions is to do with what currency are the Scots going to have.
Because that is a weak point in their argument, isn't it? And they haven't decided, and they're kind of falling back now on Plan B.
Why shouldn't they have a currency that's
D.
pegged to the pound? There's no problem with that. They had that in Ireland for decades.
Presupposes that the answer to the question is that we do think that Scotland would be better off as an independent nation, and I don't happen to think that. I visit Scotland quite often. I love going there. I still think that we are, as they say, better together.
But I mean, they could have, for example, they could join the Eurozone if they wanted to, surely, if they're an independent country.
Well, they could, but
not that the Eurozone's the greatest place in the world to hang out.
I was going to say, I think once upon a time that might have been the ambition, but because of recent issues, I don't think that would anymore be what their desired outcome would be.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can you just give us your view of this business of currency? Because it seems the Better Together campaign are really pinning most of their hopes on this thing of the SNP and the Scots wanting to have some currency which is either the pound or pegged to the pound, and the city essentially, along with the Best Care of people, saying no.
Well, I mean, if you're trying to have an independent policy, which various, I mean, the Scottish National Party has come from virtually nowhere over decades to become a very powerful force in Scotland because policy run from London has not been in their best interests, and they've been very well aware of that. But, I mean, the real radicals in the SNP want an independent currency linked to the Norwegian krona, because, of course, the Norwegians are, in fact, their model.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Well, that's right. That's what you would do.
Or the Icelandic, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at what's, you know, you can see in the North Sea, for example, there were no trade unions in the British section of the North Sea, whereas in Norway the trade unions run that run these Statoil.
You mean the oil industry?
The oil industry, yes. Okay. And so, for example, the Piper Alpha disaster, where all these guys were killed, because it was run by an American multinational company, they had the accommodation block right over the wellhead. Now, in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, they don't put the accommodation block on the same platform as the wellhead. And so if I was Scots and I was seeing all of that and saying, well, hang on a minute, why are we running like this? Norway's a perfectly successful country, very successful country. I would say one of the most successful countries in the world. And you can see why that might be attractive to Scots to say, well, why couldn't we run things like that? And I think it's good that we are having a referendum about choice. Mm. I mean, the thing is, of course, they'll have to get 50% plus one of the electorate to make it stick, whereas we've just decided to have a mayor in Bristol on, what is it, a 27% turnout of, on half of that. I mean, when you're making constitutional changes, you ought to have a threshold.
Absolutely.
And the other good thing I think about the referendum is that 16-year-olds are going to be allowed to vote in it, which also opens it up, because they may be, I mean, obviously the calculation by Alex Salmond is that they're more likely to take a daring leap into the unknown. And of course, if they were to vote for independence, and I don't think they are, that's not what the opinion polls are showing, that would then raise questions about what's left of Britain and what you know, the Welsh, well, for example, would then start to ask them, yeah, well, we're going to be permanently run by a Tory government from London, maybe we want independence,
Martin,
as well.
I think it's a wider question than that, because I think in any case, you know, you look at what the devolution to Wales is greater, it has been over the last year.
Yeah.
Scotland, whether they vote yes or no, I think there will be more devolution because, you know, they have to acknowledge that that's what the call is, even if the vote goes down. I think the question isn't about Wales saying we want more or Northern Ireland saying we want more. It's about the English regions, yes, and the English cities saying, hang on a minute, why are we all still run by London when Cardiff and Edinburgh and Belfast have got so many more powers?
But also in Cardiff, Edinburgh and Belfast, you've got essentially PR in local elections. I mean, in Belfast, it was absolutely essential in order to build the peace process forward. And eventually, we are going to ask this question. I mean, we saw the AV referendum go down at the last election. But the problem with the system we've got is that the swing constituencies around London, those small number of voters, decide everything, yeah, and it's and the spin doctors know that, and ultimately it means, for example, the people who are hard pressed in the inner city, they don't get a look in the situation, because the Labour Party basically takes their votes for granted, and they don't have to fight for them. But of course, in inner city Scotland, and I used to be working Glasgow, and it's SNP versus Labour up there in the inner cities, and in Clydebank where I used to go, they have to work hard to get the votes of those relatively disadvantaged people.
Helen, can I just ask you finally, which way is the vote going to go? Let's have your prediction.
Well, I'm not a betting person, but I have a friend who is, and they say, look at the bookies' odds, and the bookies' odds are very much against it, as well as the opinion polls. So I do think it will go down.
Do you follow the bookies, Martin?
Yes, I do, and I also follow the bookies that have been clear all along that Ed Miliband's going to be the next Prime Minister. Go into William Hill and you'll see.
Okay, on to some more stories, and this is Gaza now, and there's been a statement by the Labour leader Ed Miliband, Martin was just mentioning him there, about Gaza this week. There's a lot of people saying, well, why isn't Ed speaking out? There doesn't seem to be any kind of opposition, there seems to be a unanimity. And of course, when Ed Miliband did speak out, he was accused of playing politics. So let's have a listen to his short statement now, or part of it.
What I want to hear from David Cameron is that he believes that Israel's actions in Gaza are wrong and unjustified, and we haven't heard that from him. I believe that's what the British public are thinking as they're seeing these tragic events unfolding on our television screens.
Martin, so he's not really being outright condemning the Israeli actions or Hamas or whatever. He's not coming down on one side or the other particularly, but he is saying that there should be condemnation of some sort from David Cameron. At least, anyway, he's putting a bit of clear blue water between himself and the Tories.
Or clear red water, whichever way you want to think of it. He was also very uncomplimentary about Hamas in what he said, which I thought was very unconstructive. You know, I hate Hamas, I think Hamas are a terrible organisation. I think ultimately the West has got itself into a big mess here because they won the election in 2006. Never mind the Arab Spring. Hamas are the democratically elected government of Palestine, and the Israelis have managed to persuade the West that they are not to be spoken to or talked to or dealt with. That is a recipe for disaster, and that's why we're seeing the mess we're seeing.
And before we hear from Helen on this topic, we also heard this week the resignation of Baroness Varsi from the Conservatives. In fact, she was, I think it's probably fair to say, quite a lot stronger in her condemnation of the Israeli actions and of the British government's reaction to it than was Ed Miliband. So let's have a listen now to Baroness Varsi, a little extract from her interview on Channel 4 News.
I think the government, in relation to the current Gaza crisis, needed to be bolder in its language and more honest in its diplomacy. I've championed over the last 2 years what I consider fundamental British values, the value of the rule of law, international justice, people being held to account for crimes that they may have committed. And I just sense that the position that we're taking in relation to the Gaza crisis, where we talk about accountability in the one breath, and yet less than 2 weeks ago we abstained on a Human Rights Council resolution which talked about accountability and about having an independent inquiry into alleged war crimes. Okay. I think we've got to walk the walk and not just talk the talk, because foreign policy is about saying what you believe and then doing what you say. I think for me it's morally indefensible where after 4 weeks of a conflict, more than a quarter of the Gazan population displaced, nearly 2,000 people killed, nearly 400 innocent children killed, we still cannot find the words to say we condemn this and that we feel that this action has been disproportionate. These issues are far too serious for us to have been mealy-mouthed and for us to be dragging our heels. I think there is a sincerely held view in government that the best way to resolve this matter is to try and be as accommodating as possible to the Israeli government, to try and through that seek influence with them and through that to try and move them to a more positive decision. I'm not sure that policy is working.
Baroness Varsi there on her, speaking to Channel 4 News on her day of her resignation from the government. She had a quite important position, Helen Holland, Labour leader here in Bristol, didn't she, in the Foreign Office as a minister and also with responsibility for human rights and for the United Nations, and she's now resigned.
Well, she certainly did, and actually I've met her a couple of times because she's been to Bristol. She worked very closely with the Conservative candidate in the previous general election in Bristol East, Adila Shafi, and I met her several times, and actually I thought that she was very good, and she went up in my estimation enormously when she did resign and what she said, and I think the way that she amplified what she'd said in her tweet when she resigned and in her letter was very good on the Channel 4 interview. And I think that her resigning was a game changer, because I do think that you could see from the strength of the backlash, both from the Tories and, shockingly, I thought, from some of the Lib Dem ministers, for Ed Davey to say that, you know, she didn't need to have done it or whatever he said was quite appalling. And I thought that it was very interesting to look on social media that she had thousands of retweets of her resignation letter, and all of the bile was coming from her own side. And if that doesn't tell you that actually she'd put her finger on it when she made her statement, I don't know what does.
But I mean, there are two sides to this conflict.
There are two sides.
And the trouble is that she's seen as somebody who's just basically taking one side. And surely, from a distance, Britain should be diplomatic.
Well, being diplomatic isn't the same as not recognising that the conflict is hugely disproportionate, and the strength of the two sides is hugely disproportionate. And you've only got to see that in tragically the number who are killed and the number of civilians who are killed on the Palestinian side. And I do think that you know, what she said has made people think, and I even think, in a way, that Ed Miliband's statement came about. You know, the landscape had changed because of her resignation.
It was also interesting, Martin, wasn't it, that the ceasefire that held until today started on the same day as Baroness Varsi resigned, which is a good sign. It shows that you may possibly, you know, politicians around the world taking a stand against it can actually make a difference on the ground. And also, I note that in November last year, over in Malaysia, which we've been talking about with these airliners, Israel was charged and convicted of war crimes and genocide by the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission. So there are people pointing the finger at Israel and saying, what on earth are you doing? But Britain, at the UN, is using its veto.
Yes, because we're under the influence of the US, and the US is very dominated by Israeli politicians. I mean, the US Senate voted unanimously to support any action that Israel wanted to take in Gaza. Now, that's not the sort of thing that you're going to hear from the general population in Britain.
Or from Parliament, to be fair.
I mean, we had an interview with Gerald Kaufman, was it this week or last week? That you had done, Tony. And he's always, as a Jewish man, taken a very solid
line. And he was a former Shadow Foreign Secretary.
Indeed. And as I said then, and I'll say it, repeat it now, if Ed Miliband takes his cue from Gerald, he won't go far wrong on this. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to have a Jewish leader of the Labour Party, why ever not? And all that nonsense from the Daily Mail about they're not one of us because they're German Jews and they're not British and all the rest of it, they know they can stick that sort of attitude. But it is important that he's seen to be strong on the things we care about. But British policy has always been that because Britain was the colonial power, we do have a special responsibility towards the Palestinians. And I think ordinary people in Britain do understand that.
We've also had this week Boris Johnson stepping up onto the stage with his moppy hair. Perfect public relations man, isn't he? As the guy that sort of pretends to be kind of friendly,
bumbling,
foppish, and etc. But anyway, I mean, is he going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party? Who knows? But anyway, he's going to stand as an MP at the next general election next year. And so let's have a listen to him now and his speech. Very nicely choreographed it was too.
We've danced around it for an awfully long time now, and you know, as you know, the Prime Minister ages ago said he would welcome me back. Very kind of him to say so, and he's also been pretty clear that I can't endlessly go on dodging these questions as I've tried to do. So, let me put it this way. I haven't. You ask about Uxbridge. I haven't got any particular seat lined up, but I do think that, in all probability, I mean, since you can't do these things furtively, I might as well be absolutely clear with you. And in all probability, I will try to find somewhere to stand in 2015. It is highly likely that I will be unsuccessful in that venture. By the way, you should never underestimate the possibility of things going badly wrong. But I will try that. But one thing is absolutely clear: I will serve out my mandate here in London.
As mayor. Anyway, Helen Holden, what do you make of Boris there? Because actually he's got loads of charisma. He's a pretty formidable character.
Well, let me start with this annoys me on so many levels. First of all, being the mayor of London is a big job, and the idea that he can run two jobs together for a year is nonsensical. The other thing which I hate, and I hate it in anybody's party, including ours, is the idea that some people would be such an important gift to politics, to Westminster, that it's more important that they get in and it doesn't matter which seat they stand for. And so this kind of idea that, well, I want to be in Parliament and so I'm going to look for a seat, quite irritates me, as you can probably
okay,
tell.
Okay, Martin, is that
but,
someone
but,
in the...
But sorry, the other thing, I mean, just that on the news it showed people, they went to do a vox pop in Uxbridge, which is the seat that's being talked about as the one where he might get it. And one chap said, and I thought, you've put your finger on it absolutely, and he said, well, yeah, you know, he could make a good politician, but there's one thing, and that is we won't see very much of him round here. And that whole thing about people being in Parliament because they're in, you know, see themselves as important rather than representing their constituencies, I find is one of the big turn-offs, actually, about national politics.
Martin, at the Olympics, Boris was cozying up with Rupert Murdoch. I mean, has somebody somewhere in the city already decided this is the next leader of the Tory party?
Well, he's certainly being groomed for it, isn't he? I would also think that he's been into William Hill, and he's seen that Ed Miliband is going to be the next Prime Minister. And, of course, if he doesn't make his move now, he won't be in position to challenge Cameron after the election. Now, from a Labour point of view, what I would suggest is that this shows that they are already writing themselves out of the script.
I know you like bigging up the Labour Party's chances at the next election. Can you answer the question?
Well, what is the question, Tony?
The question, weren't you even listening to the question?
Well, I've forgotten what it was now.
Has someone, Rupert Murdoch, he was getting very cosy to him at the Olympics, right. Spotted, you know, cosying
well,
up to Murdoch.
Let's put it this way.
Also, the city. Has someone already decided, you know, never mind any members of the Conservative Party, they might be, they might not be, but has he been sort of tapped to be there?
Yes, he has. His views are extremely right wing, if you actually look at his views. He's on the right of his party. And
for example,
he's consistently opposed Tobin tax on the city and all the rest of it. He's been very much in their pocket. And if Cameron goes, he will want to jump in because there will be a very big push by the right of the Tory party to dominate the direction of play. And he's got to fit in with that if he wants to be the leader. I think it's quite good that we're now talking about Tory election defeat and how they're going to reconstitute themselves after that defeat. And it means I think the bookies are right. Labour are going to win because of the electoral system. It's not fair. You know, it's not, we won't have a majority, nothing like, but we will have a working majority, I suspect.
OK, on to some other news. A sharp rise this week in parental fines for term time holidays. The BBC have been doing a survey. The number of parental fines in England for children's poor school attendance has risen sharply since the government's ban on term time holidays was introduced. BBC research suggests 64,000 fines have been issued since the law changed in September 2013, a rise of 70% according to local authority data. More than three quarters of councils, that's 118, responded to a BBC survey. The ban has drawn opposition from parents, with hundreds of thousands signing petitions against these new rules, calling for the government to take action against holiday companies who raise their prices during school holidays. Helen, whose children are they anyway? If a parent sends their children off to school, surely it's not the school doesn't control and own the child, it's the parent's child.
Well, it is, but on the other hand, I think, you know, in term time, the place the child ought to be is in school. But this again is a story that you know, rattles me, because middle class people, they can have a cheap holiday and they can factor in the cost of the fine. But poor families, if they're trying to afford to take their family on holiday, they know that the holiday companies ratchet up the price of holidays during the school holidays, and so they're left with no choice, aren't they? It's the devil in the deep blue sea. Either they have a cheap holiday and they get fined, which they can't afford, or, you know, they don't have holidays at all.
I mean, weren't you a teacher at some time?
I was a teacher. I mean,
how would you deal with parents now if they come along and say, well, I'm not paying £60, a £60 fine, or £120 if it's not paid straight away. It's one of these, something like a parking ticket. It seems a very blunt way of doing it, especially if the parents can't afford it.
Well, and the other thing, as I understand it, the money doesn't even come to the local authority. So, you know, the local authority has to collect it, but it's on behalf of the government.
Okay,
so the whole thing is just, it just doesn't work.
Martin.
Well, I mean, I would be interested to know, what did we do in the past? How did we used to run this? I mean, how long have these fines been running?
Parents. I think it's last year that they were. September 2013, the law changed. So this is in the first year of this. And it's £60 per parent per child. Well, I mean, the obvious thing to do is to look at how much you're saving by having a holiday during term time. And if you're saving more than £60, then off you go. You may as well do it anyway.
Well, that's probably what people are calculating, isn't it?
But what are your thoughts about the rights of parents to take their children on holiday? A lot of people are saying, for example, they're taking actually a very educational and wonderful experience for the children, often, to go on these holidays, to see other cultures or whatever.
Well, it may be, but there isn't an absolute right for parents to control their children. Some parents, sadly, are not, in fact, do not, in fact, have their children's best interests at heart. The idea that parents are always 100%...
Okay, how many parents that take their kids on holiday do not have those children's best interests
at heart?
I'm
talking about the general principle.
Just give me an example of a parent that's taking their children on holiday that doesn't have those children's best interests at heart. Give me an example.
For example, feels a Fathers for Justice person might have decided to take the kids off and not bring them back. That might be an example of it.
Well, they'd only have to pay one fine.
Well, indeed. But the point of them, I'm making the wider point that children have rights as well. Parents have rights, but children have rights which are separable from parents.
If you ask a child, do you want to go on holiday? Of course they're going to say, yes, I'd love to.
Yes, all right, but we're not just talking about holidays here. I mean, for example, we insist that children are in school, and if they're only educated at home, the parents are inspected and it's checked whether they are actually capable of looking after the children, because children are often kept away from school by parents who can't really educate them adequately. And you can't just have a free... parents do not have 100% right over their children. That's why we have social services, for example, intervening when there is abuse and so on. And we all know that
but
that goes on.
This is being seen by a lot of people. It's just a cheap, a bit like the residence parking by some people, as just a cheap way of a new tax, basically.
Well, I think the other thing that you've got to factor in is the way that the holiday companies, are cleaning up on it, aren't they? They're making big savings for out of school term time holidays, and they're ratcheting up the cost of holidays during the school holidays, and that's not fair either.
No,
because
isn't.
Actually, the cost of them can't be that different between July and September.
It's profiteering anyway. One of the reasons for this, of course, is that the government's constantly trying to raise money from all sorts of different new sources wherever it can, and that's because we're in this dreadful recession, which apparently is almost over. But Martin, this is one for you. The European Central Bank this week is getting ready to do quantitative easing to pump printed money into the eurozone as fears are rising over the recovery. In The Guardian yesterday, the European Central Bank is accelerating plans to unleash fresh growth-boosting measures, they call them, as the eurozone's recovery loses steam and the risk increases of a geopolitical shock from the Ukraine crisis. Mario Draghi, president of the European Central Bank, said the bank has intensified preparatory work on quantitative easing as a potential new weapon in its battle against deflation and economic stagnation. Well, it's new in Europe, but not new elsewhere, is it?
No, I mean, quantitative easing has been happening in the US and Britain all along. And what Mario Draghi has been... I mean, there was a challenge in the Constitutional Court in Germany about whether they could do quantitative easing, and they came on the side of saying that they might. But the Bundesbank is still hostile to quantitative easing. And Germany's economy is now starting to falter. I suspect what will happen in the real world is that they will quantitative
ease. But isn't this some sort of fake recovery by just pumping money into the system?
The whole problem with all of this is that everything that's been happening since the crash is based on funny money. So the recovery in Britain is based on funny money. We've got funny money and a separate currency, which means that it can devalue against.
When you say funny money, do you mean this QE and printing
money? Yes, I mean, when I was learning economics in the 1970s at university, the idea that the government would just print money and buy assets like this would have been regarded as absolutely nuts. But we've got used to this. We've got used to it as the normal.
Okay.
And, of course, as the von Mises Institute and the other really serious free market economists know, you are just blowing a massive bubble. And when it pops, of course, it's going to be absolutely catastrophic. But, of course, when we're talking about electoral politics in Britain, we're talking within a very narrow framework where we're talking about, is this a recovery for everybody or is this a recovery just for the rich? But I question whether there is a real recovery. If you took away the quantitative easing and if there was any rise in interest rates, even a tiny rise in interest rates, the whole house of cards is going to go down the drain. Now, I hope that Ed Balls has got people around him, and I hope people in the civil service are in position to know.
You better have... Don't hold your breath, Martin.
No, well,
anyway,
well,
Helen,
I
want to get your view on how this affects us here in Bristol.
Well,
I
think that Martin's right, that the recovery is being talked up for political reasons, and people are being, they're trying to convince us that we all feel better and that we're all spending money again and all that kind of thing. But, the figure that has been used over and over again by Labour front benchers in the Commons is that most ordinary people in work are £1,600 a year worse off since the coalition came into government in 2010. And that is a real figure that people do really feel, don't they? And so the choices between heating and eating, between going on holiday or not, all of these things that we've been talking about, those are real choices for a lot of people. And how can we be in recovery when there are more people using food banks than there have ever been, when there are more people, more people in work claiming housing benefit than there have ever been? All of these things don't add up to me to sounding like a recovery.
Well, the figures look good in the city, but they certainly don't trickle down to grassroots level. Anyway, another story this week. The number of people in work claiming housing benefit has soared.
Yeah,
this is this Tuesday in the Independent, Nigel Morris writing, the number of working people relying on housing benefit to boost their income has doubled in 5 years at a cost of billions of pounds to the taxpayer, new analysis discloses. Labour will seize on the figures to argue that millions more people are trapped in insecure jobs with poverty pay despite recent evidence of economic growth. According to the House of Commons statistics, 478,000 people with jobs claimed housing benefit in 2009 and 2010. The rising to an expected 962,000 this year. So that's in 3 years, 4 years actually. It's nearly doubled, Martin. On current trends, the number of claimants will increase by a further 276,000 to just about 1.25 million in 2018 to 2019. The cost to the taxpayers climbed from 2.2 billion that is in 2009-10 to 4.6 billion. That's pretty much doubling this year. Martin, what is going on with housing benefit? It seems like many people now just have to rely on benefits just to keep the rent paid. Actually, the jobs that they're doing day to day are not paying the rent. Rents are starting to eat into our disposable income massively.
Real wages have been forced down here, of course they have. And the other thing, of course, is this housing benefit goes straight into the pockets of buy-to-let landlords, and therefore it's underpinning the property bubble. So in other words, the government is pumping up the property bubble by transferring housing benefit to to people working. That then gets paid to their landlords. Of course, if they're in social housing or council housing, that wouldn't be happening. But if they're in private housing, that's the buy-to-let bubble is being subsidised by the government. This has got nothing at all to do with free market economics. It's subsidy by the government to its political supporters.
So, it's not just about the subsidy to landlords, it's also about the subsidy to poor employers, isn't it?
Yes.
This story also gives the lie to, you know, the Daily Mail picture of people scrounging on the welfare state. We're talking about people who are in work, but the government is subsidising low pay for those companies. So, you know, this is another reason why we ought to be talking very much more about the living wage.
Yes, but I mean, it's not this government's fault this system was set up in the first place. Not during the, I think it was Monday evening, Mark Harper, who's the Minister for Disabled People, Conservative, hit back by accusing Labour of bequeathing the government an out-of-control housing benefit system and a culture of dependency.
But that's this culture of dependency stuff. The housing, the real problem here is the selling off of the council housing stock, which began in the 1980s without replacing them. And Labour were.
Looking back and saying, oh, we shouldn't have done that. But how do we deal with this situation now?
Build some more houses for relatively low-income people and do what we used to do automatically, which is provide social housing for people. In a capitalist economy with a spread of incomes, the bottom third of the society simply do not have the resources for adequate housing it's subsidised in some way.
The other thing to do, of course, is to implement the living wage so that actually it would be employers who are paying people properly, decent money, and the government wasn't having to subsidise them through housing benefit.
But Martin, isn't it the real problem here that that rents have been creeping up, as they always do, on a ratchet system? You don't get a call from your landlord saying, I'm dropping your rent, you know, at least you're very, very lucky if you do. But real wages have actually been going down and down and down.
Therefore the people at the bottom are being ground to powder.
Okay, let's have your Martin Summers, Chancellor of the Exchequer, solution. How are we going to deal with this problem? You've said build houses. That takes many years to do. How are we going to deal with it?
It does, but I mean, you've got to do that in the long run.
That's going to affect the economy in a negative way, because it means that the housing will be meeting the demand, and actually house prices are going to start going down quite sharply.
A long time for housing to meet the demand. The demand is so huge now that, you know, and the numbers of houses built under this government is lower now than it has been since the 1920s. So we've got to start meeting that demand, but it won't meet it for many years, even if they started building at thousands of units.
Okay, Martin. Okay, I'll answer that one.
Well,
then.
The point is that there's a bubble blowing anyway, which could burst. But by building houses, you slow the growth of the bubble. You don't. We ought to be saying to people, as they do in Germany, nobody should expect to make money from their housing. A house is a place to live in. And, you know, if you've got any spare cash, invest it in a business.
OK, before we leave the subject, in Iceland, one of the solutions to their financial... And they're well out of their financial crisis now, was to actually spend more on benefits. So, in Iceland, they might see this increase in housing benefit as something quite positive.
Well, in actual fact, you've got to... As things stand, you can't just cut people off benefits. So, to reduce the housing benefit bill, you've actually got to build houses and gradually change the dynamics of the system. But you can't cut people off... Can you? I mean, inevitably, we end up spending money because of the mistakes that have been made in the past because the economy's in a mess.
With the bedroom tax, effectively, people are being cut off, Helen. You know, landlords are saying, no, well, if you can't pay for that extra bedroom, I mean, this is social landlords as well. They're having to evict people, some of them.
Well, at least we've got a as near as we can promise from the mayor that, you know, evicting people whose arrears arise from the bedroom tax in Bristol, that he is going to do everything he can not to evict them, which has been our call to him over the last 18 months, and he didn't agree with that stance to begin with. But, you know, one of the things is that a lot of people who are affected by the bedroom tax actually do want to move. They do want to move to smaller accommodation, and Bristol, like many other cities, has not got that smaller accommodation. So there are all sorts of people stuck in unsuitable accommodation. But the other thing that I wanted to say was around the living wage and about pump priming, if you like, the economy. Because the fact is that if poor people get more money in their pocket, they spend it. It's not like giving middle class people more money, because what they do is just increase their savings, or they overpay their mortgage, which again is, you know, inflates the value of their savings. But poor people go out and spend it. And so if we want to see Broadmead busy, we want poorer people to be able to go down there and be spending money that they've got in their pockets.
Okay, well, staying on benefits, former Department of Work and Pension staff are going rogue, well, rogue in inverted commas, to help benefit claimants. This is in last weekend's Independent on Sunday, I should say. Three disgruntled former civil servants have been inundated with pleas to help after they set up a website offering emergency advice to welfare claimants who believe their benefits have been wrongly docked. Three women behind the initiative, who all work for the Department for Work and Pensions, allege that many job centre staff are instructed to veto a set proportion of claimants. The allegation is strongly denied by the department. The women, who are based in the northeast of England, have not made their names public but launched the website in June without any fanfare. The last few days it's gone viral, and the women have been bombarded by claimants accusing Department for Work and Pensions of unfairly cutting their benefits. On one day last week, the website Job Seekers Sanction Advice, that's www.jobseekersanctionadvice.com, received 200 messages, half from people protesting against being wrongly penalised. The website organisers, who've called on support from five other people with DWP experience, worked until after midnight to clear the backlog. One of the organisers, Jean, in inverted commas, said she had become disillusioned by the treatment meted out to some claimants during her final years at the job centre, alleging staff were pressurised, Martin, to sanction needy people for the smallest mistake in their claim.
I think the evidence is mounting up that people in the DWP have been told that they've got to reach targets for sanctioning people, which I think is absolutely unfair. If people do not fulfil what's expected of them, fair enough, but you shouldn't be looking to find fault with people. And then, of course, these people then end up, where do they end up? They end up in a food bank. And what we really need in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the World War II is a robust welfare state. Let's shout it from the rooftops. The welfare state is a good thing. And actually, what it does, for example, when the economy crashed a few years ago, it provides a cushion under the economy. Without a welfare state, which many developing countries haven't got, when the economy crashes, it goes straight down the drain. The welfare state actually prevents the crash from turning into a worse crash than it should be. And in fact, a welfare state is not an optional add-on of a modern capitalist economy. It's an essential feature, and you will see that countries like Norway or Finland, which have extensive welfare states, also have a much more efficient economy.
But the present government, Ian Duncan Smith, probably, Helen, I think, probably would like to abolish the welfare state. He'd like to be rid of it for good.
Well, I mean, in many ways, you can see a foretaste of that now, because people who are put on sanctions are left with no money whatsoever while the sanctions in place. And then, you know, the DWP catching up with people's changed circumstances. It seems to me, certainly people come to my surgery, I hear from people who are left with nothing. And it's almost like going back to the poor law. It's quite dreadful. And Martin's right, the increase in the number of people reliant on food banks, and some of the outrageous things that we've heard Tory ministers saying about food banks. Nobody would go there by choice, and it isn't like you think, oh, you know, shall I go to Asda this weekend or shall I pop to the food bank? It's not like that. You aren't eligible to go to the food bank unless you've got vouchers from the job centre.
Martin, we've also had criticism of the Universal Job Match again this week, with people who are basically fraudsters being able to advertise on Universal Job Match, getting people who are desperate for jobs into their clutches. So you, as a benefit claimant yourself, you use this system. What are your thoughts about that, as well as this sanction system?
Well, the system is, I mean, for example, I go on Universal Job Match every day and do what I'm supposed to do. But a lot of people, I mean, I've got a degree, I can manage it. Lots of people can't. They're not actually computer literate.
Haven't got
access to a computer. So this whole thing has been based on a delusionary idea of what, I mean, what they're trying to do is using the economic crisis to engage in regressive social planning, so that we go on about the lifestyles of people on benefits and so on. The fundamentals are that the banking system has been bailed out to the tune of billions, and instead of clawing that back from those concerned, we're turning our fire on the people at the bottom of society. And of course, in the US, which has a much welfare state much less more denuded than ours, of course you've then got a massive crime. You know, you've got huge numbers of people running around with guns, robbing liquor stores, and that's modernisation. The conservative, we want to be more dynamic like the United States of America. Well, you better get used to some gunfire if that's where you want to go.
I think it's immoral, isn't it, the way that they talk about there are actually more people in work. That might be true, that more people are working, but that doesn't equate to the fact that we've got more young people out of work than we've had for many years. So, you know, these things just don't add up. And when they're talking about more people employed, they're talking about people in part-time, zero-hours contracts, all those kinds of, you know, poor employment practice.
Okay, another story. A couple of lines only in the Bristol Post. Well, I would have thought something that really should be hitting the national newspapers, which isn't. That is the former mayor of Weston-super-Mare, Philip Judd. He's to be sentenced next month over child abuse images. Well, we were told he was going to be sentenced last month. This is the former town mayor who admitted downloading more than 350 indecent pictures and videos of children. He's due to be sentenced on the 15th of September. Philip Judd, 60 years old, pleaded guilty to 12 charges of making indecent photographs of a child and possessing prohibited images when he appeared at Bristol Crown Court. The court was told he was found with 151 films and 200 indecent images of children during a search of his home in Trenley Drive in Wirral, Weston-super-Mare. Judd was the mayor of Weston-super-Mare between 2010 and 2011, and is also a former vice chairman of North Somerset Council. But one thing that doesn't get a mention in the article, for whatever reason, is the fact that he was a Conservative mayor and also a Conservative member of North Somerset Council. Another thing is that he is also a Freemason, is a Master Mason at St. Q Lodge, 1222. That's 1222 Masonic Lodge in Weston. So, Helen, I'll come to you first on this. I find the reporting of this one particularly strange. First of all, the sentencing being delayed again and again. And secondly, that a former mayor who's got these child abuse images, a child pornographer, I would have thought that's actually quite an important story and we deserve to know a little bit more about this. And the fact that the fact that he's a Tory seems to be airbrushed out of the Bristol Post's report and all other reports about him.
Well, I can't comment on the reasons why the sentencing has been delayed, but you know, if he's pleaded guilty, then I don't see what the delay is.
Martin, what about this? I mean, it looks to me as if someone is airbrushing his Toryness out of this story.
Well, that may be so, Tony, that may be so. But, I mean, it's very hard to comment on individual cases like this. We all know that there is a problem with this. And with, you know, with the recent revelations that have been going on about networks possibly leading into government and so on. But as I've said to you before, the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was used by the MI5 as a... a honey trap for loyalist paramilitaries in the 1980s and 1990s, and that was Ken Livingstone's maiden speech was about this when he went into Parliament from being Mayor of London. And what worries me about the paedophile networks at the heart of power, if you like, is the possibilities of blackmail and the control of political activity by those who are caught in that net.
Okay, so that's Philip Judd. We'll watch with great interest to see how that's reported. As this former Tory mayor of Weston-super-Mare, child pornographer found with 151 films and 200 indecent images, particularly looking at the way this is reported, despite the delays in his sentencing. He's out on unconditional bail still, apparently now. The emergency waiting times at the flagship £430 million Southmead Hospital, which was a PFI deal, signed off by the finance officer up at North Bristol Trust, who's now in charge of legal services at Bristol City Council. As soon as he'd got the beginnings of the building work done at North Bristol Trust at Southmead, he's then disappeared from the trust, which is a great pity. I would have thought any finance officer worth their salt would see the PFI deal right the way through, but he's now Liam Neville. He's now the chief solicitor, I think, at Bristol City Council. But anyway, Helen, this isn't looking good, is it? They're going from bad to worse, these emergency waiting times. First, nobody could find a space to park, and then 180 operations were cancelled because theatres were unfinished. Now the trust which runs Bristol's new £430 million super hospital has apologised unreservedly as the number of patients waiting longer than 4 hours to be seen in accident and emergency falls way below the government's target. It's not looking good up at Southmead.
Well, I'm sorry, but I do feel I feel very sorry for people whose operations have been delayed or have been in A&E for long periods of time waiting for treatment. But on the other hand, it seems like the Bristol Evening Post and some of the Bristol media are just waiting for, you know, a bad news story. They want to say, oh, here's a super hospital, but it's not as good. And I think there are teething problems and they've got to be sorted out. And it's very important that the North Bristol Trust get it right. But I think, you know, there is another side to this story, and there are people who have been very satisfied with their treatment in Southmead, and it is a fantastic facility for us to have here in Bristol. Can I pull you up, Tony, a little bit, because I don't think what you said around... did I understand you to say that somebody who'd worked at the North Bristol Trust now works for the City Council?
Head of Legal Services, isn't he, Liam, I think? Unless it's a different Liam Nevin.
Yeah, I think it is, because Liam Nevin, as far as I understand, didn't come from the North Bristol Trust.
Okay, well, apologies if I've got that wrong. Anyway, Martin, this is a PFI. It doesn't all seem to be going. Will you agree with Helen there that really we should be allowing Southmead these teething difficulties, or do you think it's just not acceptable?
Are you talking to me or to Taylor? Oh, well, I'm opposed to PFI deals. It's a ridiculous way to fund public infrastructure. The public ends up paying a lot more than they would if the government had just borrowed the money and built the thing.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest. That was Councillor for Whitchurch Park, leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. After the Murdoch News, more of everything Britain's mainstream media is keeping from you.
From the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. American fighter jets have carried out airstrikes on Islamic State extremists in northern Iraq. Thousands of refugees have been forced to flee the militants. The US Secretary of State has warned the situation shows all the signs of genocide. Meanwhile, Defence Secretary Michael Fallon says Britain's ready to provide technical assistance to support US humanitarian airdrops.
Our focus is on assisting that humanitarian mission and using our military in support of the Americans in terms of refueling and surveillance to underpin their mission and to add to it with food drops of our own.
Well, those British food drops will include £2 million of supplies, including water and tents. Meanwhile, British Airways has decided to stop flying over Iraq as the conflict continues. Countries affected by the Ebola outbreak are being told to step up border checks as an international...